Welcome to The Sync Report, the intersection between filmmakers, content creators, and musicians, where we host a weekly conversation with some of the biggest names in film, television, music, and entertainment. Meet industry experts and top-level musicians as we pull the curtain back on music placement and scores, building vital relationships and providing real opportunities for our listeners. Listen to indie filmmakers and content creators present their latest productions and describe specific scenes as they consider music submitted by our audience. Hosted by film star and musician Colin O'Donoghue and his co-host, the godmother of independent films, Rose Ganguza, and The Sync Report's creator and music supervisor, Jason P. Rockwell. Don't forget, tell your friends about us and remember to rate, comment and subscribe to The Sync Report on Apple and across all platforms. Music is the difference between a good film and a great one.
Welcome to The Sync Report.
Thank you, Milfredo and Willow, for that lovely introduction, and welcome to The Sync Report. Let's welcome our producer extraordinaire, Paula Flack. Paula, who have we got on the show this week?
Colin, we have Stuart Clarke on the show this week. Stuart Clarke arrived in Ireland at the height of the Pirate Wars. As a pioneering pirate DJ, he was broadcasting from the offshore trawler Radio Caroline, as well as from the Voice of Peace off the coast of Israel. He began working in journalism at the Limerick Tribune and has since risen the ranks at Hot Press magazine to become the deputy editor. Apart from his work at Hot Press, he is a regular contributor to Matt Cooper's The Last Word on Today FM and as a talking head on various TV programmes such as TV3, RTE and Setanta Sports. His words of wisdom have also appeared in non-musical publications such as Food and Wine, TV Now and The Sunday Business Post. Stuart also guest lectures at Pulse College. Please welcome Stuart Clarke.
Hey. Welcome to The Sync Report, Stuart. It's an extra special show for me. I played a pirate on Once Upon a Time, but you are the real deal. I can't wait to dive into your career. So glad to have you this evening. Did you always know that you'd have a career involved in music in some way?
I was about sort of 6 or 7 and I just became obsessed with music and with radio and with magazines. So the three things kind of coalesced, and I was doing fanzines from the age of 10 or 11. I found a few recently, and they're very embarrassing, as they should be. But I was lucky. Yeah, I had those passions really early on.
You were writing for fanzine at that age?
Yeah. We did a school one, and then I started a pirate radio fanzine called Free Radio Waves. We sold about 200 copies, and then I started selling cassettes, good old-fashioned cassettes, radio from all over the world, including America. A mate of mine built transmitters, so I helped him flog those. So I was kind of wheeling and dealing, you know, in that pirate radio world from my early kind of teens or preteens.
Incredible. Wow.
What year were you doing that?
Well, this was back in 1976 and 1977, just as punk rock hit. So that was something else that kind of fed into my enthusiasm, playing all these cool records that were banned by the BBC.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Was there a particular song that stands out for you as one of your earliest recollections?
Well, I think the first album I bought was Bolan's Boogie. To this day, I love T-Rex. It was very sad when he passed away. Gloria Jones will soon be in Ireland. There's a documentary being made about her, Mark's partner. Then it was David Bowie, seeing him do Starman on Top of the Pops. It's a familiar tale, but honestly, I remember pre-Bowie in kind of black and white, then glorious Technicolor. After Bowie, he made it all sort of possible and made you realize you could be what you wanted to be. I came from a similar sort of pretty gray kind of beige satellite town to London. Nothing much happened, and I thought, well, if Bowie can do this, I can. And then the real moment, the epiphany, was hearing John Lydon going, I am an antichrist, I am an anarchist. Anarchy in the UK by the Sex Pistols, because for the first time that was mine. It belonged to me. I was 13 and I thought I was the only person in the world listening to Sex Pistols. And all the best bands, the one that you can, you know, claim ownership of. And I really claimed ownership of the Pistols and then the Clash.
Wow.
Talking my music now.
Yeah, we actually have a clip of Jeepster by T-Rex. And after we hear the clip, I want to sort of know what it was about the track that made you pay attention to it and to Mark Bolan. if you want to play it there, Manfredo. Brilliant.
That still sends shivers.
I know, yeah. It still sounds great. It still sounds fresh, you know what I mean? I think.
Totally.
Very much so. I mean, I happen to be heterosexual, but I've always loved a man in makeup. And I just thought that, you know, Mark Bolan looked so exotic. The feather boas and the corkscrew hair and all that kind of thing. And then, of course, Bowie took it an extra dimension or two. So I suppose, in a way, you're 7 or 8 and Mark Bolan was almost like a cartoon.
I think they sort of knew each other, didn't they? Mark Bolan and David Bowie, like early on in their careers.
They were before they really rivals. Made it. Yeah, it was kind of tit for tat. You know, they were both kind of ace faces in the mod scene. And they kept on reinventing themselves every 5 minutes. But Bowie was better, perhaps, at reinventing than Bolan, although Mark did it several times before he became a pop star. But yeah, there was a healthy and maybe unhealthy rivalry there.
I didn't know that.
So I'm always curious about why, on your side of the Atlantic, these trends and these sounds tend to be born, and then we kind of in the United States follow afterwards. But these were all very unique individuals. Did you feel that they were that unique at the time when you were listening to them as a kid?
Yeah, because there were so many sort of identical kind of bland pop bands, and they sort of really stood out. Actually, in fairness to America, we must be fair, I think it probably was the New York Dolls and Iggy Pop that sort of lit the paper for punk in London. I didn't realize at the time how studiously Malcolm McLaren had gone to New York and copied everything he learned with the Dolls, and then put a British spin on it, and you know, obviously then sort of started on this amazing trek to kind of poke two fingers at the establishment.
Yeah. I was thinking about all of this the other day because the Chelsea Hotel has just reopened and been restored, and it brought back a lot of those stories, especially the story about Sex Pistols and everything else. Kind of interesting. So were there any moments that you would consider pivotal for your connection to music and maybe even what might have been culturally defining for you at the time?
Yeah, I remember I came from a fairly comfortable middle class upbringing, and I felt middle class guilt for ages, but it wasn't really my fault. But the Clash were playing an outdoor gig in Brixton in a park, and we had to assemble in Trafalgar Square and march 4 or 5 miles. And I thought it'd be a bit cheeky going to a free concert without buying into the bit for the band. So I went on this Rock Against Racism march, and I was being handed leaflets, and I was talking to a load of different people. And somebody said, oh, there were skinheads down Brick Lane last night beating up the Pakistani and Bangladeshi community. And I was going, what? It was just this eye-opener that there are other people out there living lives that were totally different to me. And I think, you know, The Clash, Joe Strummer, St. Joe, gave me that social conscience that I think, you know, I still have to a degree. But I needed a wise teacher like him.
That's crazy. We have a clip of Starman by David Bowie. Milfredo, one of my favorites.
Great music tonight. That's Colin's theme song for this show.
What a tune.
Yeah.
So, Stuart, at 16 or 17, you got into punk, and tell us a little bit more about the Sex Pistols, the Clash, the Damned, all of these groups, you know, and were you aware of their New York counterparts and everything, and what did you take out of that period?
Well, we became aware when the Ramones turned up and Iggy Pop and Johnny Thunders came across and unfortunately brought Heron with him, but that's another story. In the early days, you know, it was just a handful of people. You recognized everybody. You'd go to the gigs, you'd go to the Clash, you'd bunk off school and go up there and hang around the stage door, and you'd meet Mick Jones with his brand new pair of Doc Martens. You go into the gig and the visceral thrill, I've never seen anything like it. Now, all of this has to be sort of framed through the fact that I think when you're 13, everything seems more exciting. I'm sure had I been 13 when other things hit, I'd have been equally as passionate. But the fact it was on my doorstep, it was rebellious. It's funny, there's a new Danny Boyle series called Pistol. And I've just been doing some interviews for it for Hot Press. And one of them was with Maisie Williams, the star of Game of Thrones. Very sweet lady and really into it. But I was trying to explain to her how actually dangerous the Sex Pistols felt. It felt like sedition.
Yeah.
It was the Queen's Jubilee, and there was Lydon and the gang saying, God save the Queen, a fascist regime. And it was really infuriating people. And I feel sorry for kids nowadays because it takes a lot more to wind people up. As a 13-year-old spotty little boy, all I needed was a Sex Pistols T-shirt of people running away from me. It was quite actually powerful and intoxicating. You know, and I was the worst punk rocker, you know, curly hair and cherubic face, a bit overweight. I didn't look menacing. But old ladies would still run away from me. And it felt very powerful. And that ability to rebel and to feel like you might topple the monarchy. I mean, obviously now I realize it's never going to happen. But you really felt like something was going on. For about 12 months, there was that air of something in the air.
I mean, how did you feel when it got really, really, really dark? And, you know, I mean, because eventually, when everything crashes and burns.
Yeah, it was supposed to be something new. It wasn't meant to be the same old cliches. And then suddenly these people who were reinventing rock and roll were succumbing to the tiredest cliches, very sad ones. I suppose, you know, Sid Vicious would have been the epitome of that.
Yeah.
You know, probably a fairly sort of, well, not benign character. I mean, obviously poor Nancy Spungen, mustn't forget that. But very easily led, looking for something, quite a damaged individual from his sort of background. It was very sad. You did have the very keen intellect of Johnny Rotten, John Lydon, who kind of knew when the game was up. I knew how to bail and when to bail, and he wouldn't let Malcolm McLaren drag the Pistols through the mud and sully their reputation. But Lydon wasn't part of it. So I have a lot of respect. I mean, Lydon has become a bit of a caricature of himself, a Trump supporter, which is not great, or certainly there are elements of Trump he excuses, but I think he's still being a provocateur. But I still think he had the credibility to actually get out of there while the going was good, like Paul Weller knocking the Jam on the head at the height of their fame, people baying for more. He'd had enough of it, though, and he felt straitjacketed. What basically happened was punk came along to do away with the rules, but brought with it a new set of rules, and it became everything it had set out to destroy. And I must admit, when people say to me, I'm a punk rocker, I love Green Day, I can't even explain to them what's wrong with that. It's just kind of like, okay, that's punk rock. All right, grand. For me, punk is kind of the drill scene in London. It's guys like Stormzy. It's people doing stuff without permission that is different of its time. They do it and they move on.
Right.
Do you think that's a scene? Do you think that's like a movement? Because I was just kind of thinking there, the last sort of big movement in music that I remember, I guess, was grunge in sort of the 90s. And since then it's become like, I guess there's grime and stuff, isn't there? But... Are they the same thing as, like, do you know what I mean? Like a massive wave where there's a big change where control is taken back by the artist, essentially.
I think so. You look at these kind of drill artists in London, and it can be problematic because some are linked to gangs. But at the same time, they're doing their own thing. They're doing guerrilla gigs in car parks and abandoned sort of buildings. They really aren't liked by the police. You know, the Metropolitan Police in London have a whole squad now devoted to drill music, so they're doing something right.
Mm.
Do you know what, though? On that note, I went to a gaming, and this sounds awful, like a gaming convention with my lad once, and it was just, I hated it. I absolutely hated it. But my son turns around and said to me, he said, you're not supposed to like it, Dad. And I just thought, oh my God, this is the new punk rock. It was just like, I know it wasn't like anti-establishment, but he was like, the way he looked at me, well, why would you, you know? And I thought, yeah, there it is. This is punk rock. It's just, you know, your parents are not supposed to like it. And I didn't, you know.
You're spot on. If my dad had bought Home, Nevermind the Bollocks, I would never have listened to it. But him saying, no son of mine will bring a Sex Pistols record into this house was a red rag to bull. It made it so much more fun. And sure. My stepson is much more conservative than me. And I'm like, going, what time do you call this? It's only 10:30. You should be out at 2 o'clock in the morning and you've come home sober again, young man. There's actually a new wave of conservatism, which is quite worrying.
Stuart, I think you might appreciate this. And, you know, going back to what you're saying about the Jam and the Pistols and, you know, Johnny Rotten, I was very close with Strummer, managed him for many years, and I saw a different perspective, which might illuminate what you're saying. Joe at one point got an offer for 6 million sterling to reunite the Clash for one night in London. And we were at a party up in the Hollywood Hills. Miles Copeland was there, all these wonderful people. And Joe pulls me in the backyard and says he needs to talk to me. I'm like, oh God, I'm getting fired. What's happening? And he sits down on the bench and I could see almost like tears welling up in his eyes as he's telling me about this offer. And me, as a huge Clash fan, I'm like, oh my God, the Clash are going to reunite. This is the greatest thing ever. I'm going to be responsible for. And then he told me, he goes, but, you know, and he goes, look, I know, you know, I want to do it for Topper. I want to do it for Paul. And, you know, it'd be great to be on stage with Mick again. But to be honest, you know, if I do this, I feel like I'm telling my fans I have nothing new to contribute. And it was that moment I was, you know, you could see why these guys had to stop the train. They had to get off to do that next phase of what they felt as an artist. And it is such a difficult decision. You could see the pain in Strummer, even right now, as I'm telling you the story, like my heart is breaking. Mm. And I probably am the guy that is responsible for the Clash not reuniting, because I was the only one to stand next to Joe and allow him to continue with the Mescaleros. So I just had to share that with you.
It's great to hear. I mean, after Joe passed away, you know, Mick could have gone out as the Clash or a version of, but he preferred to start a brand new band with Tony James and work his way up from the toilet circuit, you know, doing it the old fashioned way. And he could have been on a couple of million for going out, just him and Simon and Topper. It's like, you know, Fergal Sharkey was offered the Undertones reunion tour. And he said, look, I'm actually going to be turning 40 on the first day of that proposed tour. I'm not singing Teenage Kicks, age 40, in a field in Belgium. And again, you know, the other band members were a bit like, oh, it's our payday. But he was going, look, lads, I'm so sorry. I can't do it. That song meant something.
It's unbelievable. You know, we just had Rad Scabies on the show, and before he came on, I was talking with Raddy, and he was telling me, he's like, you know, I am in two minds. I'm excited about getting the band back together, but as a blah 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 age man, you know, to do Damn songs at that speed, at that velocity, you know, what do we do? Do we slow it down? I don't know what to do. And it was, you know, it's like we don't need, as fans, as music lovers, we just don't even think about that mental process that these guys have to go through. We just want them to happen, you know?
Yeah.
There's virtually no band I've seen 30 years after the fact that's reformed who are as good as they were back in the day.
Right.
There's the odd exception. Like, I have to admit, I was skeptical, but when David Johansen rebooted the New York Dolls and did a couple of albums, those albums stand with the early stuff and the shows are amazing. So New York Dolls, Johansen, you know, an exception to the rule, but most other punk bands. And you know what? It's just become what I hated back then. You know, I used to look at Teddy Boys going like, you know, granddad, 15 years ago, mate, things have moved on. And I'm afraid punk's become exactly as staid as the Teddy Boys scene. It's just become so sort of safe. But look, you know, there's lots of really great music out there, so we don't need to worry about, you know, the future. Yeah. There are plenty of kids making their own stuff without my permission, without Mr. Warner's permission, without anybody's permission. And it's great to hear.
Should we do a little tribute to Joe? You want to hear some White Riot?
Yeah.
Milfredo, play us some Clash. That song never gets stale.
Yeah, it stands the test of time.
Yeah, absolutely. But Stuart, I'll tell you what, I wanted to go back a little bit to something that you said earlier on about when you were a teenager and you started working at your own pirate radio station. I mean, I take it you were in school at the time.
Yeah, I was at school, doing okay, actually, managing to sort of muddle my way through. I fell in with some older lads who used to broadcast from the fields of Kent and the tower blocks of London. So you'd be going up onto the sort of top story of a 21 sort of block, kind of tower block, and putting aerials up and dangling over the roof and, you know, with a biscuit tin transmitter covering half of London. And you'd, you know, get a telephone box and stick somebody in there and give out a telephone number. You get like 150 calls over the course of an evening. Unfortunately, those listening included the post office. You'd turn up and raid you, and you'd have to run away and try and get your transmitter before they got it. So it's a bit of a cat and mouse. And I'll be honest with you, the illegality at first was a great attraction, then became a pain in the ass. But, you know, again, it felt quite rebellious to be doing that. And you're kind of learning more doing it than sort of going to school or college. Well, I was too young to go to broadcast college, but, you know, having real listeners phoning up and saying that was rubbish or that was great was a good way to learn.
I mean, I don't think people, you know, I guess people of a certain age don't realize how much effort and how difficult it was to set up a pirate radio station, because everybody can broadcast from their phone nowadays, you know what I mean?
You could get everything. Can you imagine a time when the music you love is outlawed? I mean, insane.
Well, this was the thing. It was banned. You know, you couldn't hear punk. So one of the only ways to kind of do it outside of John Peel was to broadcast yourself.
And so what then brought you over to Ireland, you know, and what age were you when you sort of came over here?
I was about 18 years of age, and the previous Christmas, I'd been caught broadcasting from the woods across from my house. I had a wheelbarrow with a transmitter and a couple of car batteries coming back after a broadcast, and the police turned up because where I lived was just across the way from West Heath School, which, funny enough, is where Princess Diana went to school, somewhat after my time around there. But it was a lot of very, very posh, well-connected ladies, many of nobility and of royal stock. So they thought I was a terrorist. So they're a bit disappointed when they found out I was actually a pirate radio broadcaster, but that didn't go down too well with my dad. So some older lads who'd been on this pirate station on a boat off the coast of Israel called the Voice of Peace, who I knew, came back and said, we've got this idea to go to Ireland. They've got no broadcasting laws. There's a loophole which is being exploited. Do you want to, like, you know, £500 each and all the gear we've got, we'll drive over and we'll find somewhere to broadcast from and give it a go. And this was like 1981 at the height of the hunger strikes. You know, I think in fairness, Irish people were getting a worse time in London than, you know, English people were getting in Ireland. But it was a weird thing to do, to rock up with a car full of spares in Tremor in the middle of winter. So we found a mobile home we broadcast from and lived in. This was in February. We had no heating. We had no running water. It was pretty, pretty rough. But again, when you're that age and doing something you love, you don't care.
Mm-hmm. And who was listening at that? Like, was it in the UK or was it in Ireland or was it all over Europe? Who was listening?
This now was a local radio station for Tremor. It couldn't be anything more than local because our transmitter was so tiny. And it was pretty slim pickings. But then the summer came and suddenly the whole town sort of woke up and we got loads of advertising. And bit by bit, we managed to sort of buy bigger equipment and, you know, broadcast into Waterford, the big city, you know, about 12 miles away. And then we got an even bigger transmitter and we're being heard along the Welsh coast. And we got, I wouldn't say he's an evangelist, but a guy called Roy Masters. Probably now I wouldn't want to broadcast him. He is a sort of a motivational guy with some rather sort of strange ideas. We put him out for an hour every night and that paid all our bills. So yeah, we sort of built it bit by bit. And I left after a couple of years, but the lads stayed and it turned into a really great station that unfortunately eventually got to close down because they brought in legal radio. And needless to say, ABC had been a bit not out there, but it was aggressively commercial. We didn't sort of have the local parish priest on every Sunday, that kind of thing. So when they were giving out the licenses, they were looking for that sort of public service thing. And we, you know, didn't fit into that. So unfortunately, after about 6 years, it closed. But yeah, it was 40 years ago at the start of March that it started. And I can't believe it's a lifetime ago.
Wow. And so you left Ireland and you went to the Italian border. Is that right?
Yeah. Again, you know, there are broadcasting loopholes to be exploited. We broadcast down the coast to all the posh places, Monton, Nice, Monte Carlo in English. It's great. We used to get invited down to parties on yachts when the owners weren't there. Some of the best parties were on the yacht owned by Yul Brynner. And Yul used to come along for like 2 weeks every summer on this amazing yacht that was anchored in Monaco. And the rest of the time, he sort of kept a crew on board and they had these amazing parties. I don't know if you knew about them, but that was great. And there was this kind of network, you know, you'd meet people and say, oh, I've been on the Voice of Peace in Israel. It's really cool. You should go there. So I went there. So there was all these places you could go to. You're being paid naughtpence halfpenny, but again, you didn't care. You're gaining experience. Mm-hmm. You're meeting people. You're learning the trade and having an adventure, I suppose.
There was a wonderful movie in 2009 that Richard Curtis did with Bill Nighy and Kenneth Branagh and Philip Seymour Hoffman. It was called The Boat That Rocked. I don't know if you remember. It was about pirate radio, and it was an incident in 1966. That gives me a little context because I remember seeing the movie. But how did you wind up transitioning from land stations to working on a ship? And give us a little context as to what was happening at the time politically and how pirate radio and music played an important part in that.
Well, the Voice of Peace was a really interesting station. It was seed funded in the early 70s by John Lennon, amongst many others. And it was run by an Iranian Jew called A.B. Nathan. And A.B. had been imprisoned for talking to Yasser Arafat because it was illegal for Israeli citizens to even talk to members of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, or in fact, Palestinians. So he started the station up. The idea was English DJs broadcasting nothing but music and messages of peace. The idea being that a kid in Israel could be listening at the same time as a kid in Egypt, a kid in Jordan, a kid in Syria. So it's to give like some commonality. I think, to be honest, by the time I'd arrived, it had more become a quasi-local radio station for Tel Aviv, but it was still pumping out the peace messages. And, you know, I respected AB a lot for doing that.
We're going to play a clip of Give Peace a Chance by John Lennon.
If that's not
so
poignant at the moment, my God.
The interesting story was that John Lennon phoned up AB and said, look, I've included your name on this song I've just recorded, you know, Give Peace a Chance. And AB was chuffed until he heard it. And John had rhymed AB Nathan with masturbation. So he's less impressed by that. But, you know, he gets a name check. That's the main thing. But, yeah, I mean, he was quite a visionary. And he got up people's noses and he did a lot of really, really good work. Then he sort of broadened it and was helping sort of orphans and disadvantaged people in South America with proceeds from the station. He had a lot of projects all over the world. So he's now sadly no longer with us, but a great man.
But you were so young, Stuart. I mean, going to all of these places at that point in time and everything. You're like the kid in Almost Famous, but instead of writing for Rolling Stone, you were working in pirate radio, which sounds a little bit even more adventurous.
It got rough in the Mediterranean, funnily enough. Well, the boat wasn't really meant to be at sea. It was meant to go from point A to B. So you'd have a 4-7 gale, which is nothing. And the boat would be rocking. And several times we had to crawl along the passageways with life jackets. There was one night we were told to get ready to abandon the boat. That was a bit scary.
Where were you going to go?
Overboard.
we'd asked for the army and the navy to come out. There was an SOS distress call. But where it sort of like really hit me was it was a relatively peaceful time in Israel and around. You couldn't cross into the other countries, but you could go to Bethlehem and Nazareth and everywhere. There was no problem. I was at the Wailing Wall one day. We used to pirate the news in Hebrew from Kol, Israel. And right. the Bulletin, there was a point we sort of opted out of it, and it just kept going, and I could hear people screaming, and I didn't speak Hebrew. And there'd been an attack at the Wailing Wall and about 8 or 9 people killed. So you suddenly realize that you're in a pretty dangerous kind of theater sort of a thing. But it's funny because I don't want to get too deep and political. You know, going to Israel was very interesting because the average Israeli person you met was very, very welcoming. And on a human level, they seemed fantastic. But they had such a negative, the majority, not everybody, of course, such a negative view of the Arab world. It was quite upsetting. Yeah. But Israel was such a weird mix. Like, you know, I was a young lad from Sevenoaks and I'd never sort of seen transsexuals, trans people. And they had one of the biggest and still do sort of trans scenes in the whole of the world. In fact, you know, as a society, they're very tolerant of certain things and not others. Look, I haven't been in Israel for 20 or 30 years now, so I'm not qualified to comment, but it was an interesting country. A lot of positives, a lot of things that I was a bit sort of queasy about.
But how long would you stay on the boat? For how long a period of time would you be on the boat and not on land?
We were on the boat for about 3 weeks and then off for about sort of 10 days. So you got put up in a hotel and given a couple of $100 and made your own entertainment, which was easy enough to do because, to be honest, we were kind of superstars. I mean, there wasn't much else back in those days, you know, apart from radio. And, you know, young kids, there wasn't much TV in Israel at the time. We were seen as being glamorous. We were hardly glamorous, but, you know, the English voices, it was something different. You know, we'd arrive back at the hotel and go, why are there 40 or 50 people outside? What are they waiting for? Who's walking in? And you'd realize it was for you and that they'd be, you know, looking at the boat and or they'd heard from somewhere that the crew were coming off. And I still have a couple of the listeners, we used to call them the Junior Fan Club, who send me sort of Christmas cards and stuff and letters every year, which is really sweet.
Great. So, God, Stuart, you're like a music warrior, you know, like you've been doing it since you were knee high, you know, starting off writing about it and then playing it, you know, going against the odds to make sure people could access this music. And then you shift back into journalism, which, you know, I'm curious what made you pivot there. And if you could conclude and tell our listeners your story about interviewing Joe, which just hit me right in the heart. I just think it's the coolest thing.
Yeah, it was great. Just the very quick version is I did The Voice of Peace and I went on to the original boat that rocked, albeit the 80s version, Radio Caroline in the North Sea. And then I was kind of commuting backs and forwards to see friends in Ireland, all that kind of thing, as well as doing radio in the UK. And they closed the Pirates down in Ireland. And there was a local newspaper and the guy said, you know, we're going to concentrate now on our newspaper side of things rather than the radio station. Do you want to do a column? And I said, oh yeah, I wrote a little bit. So I started doing a music column. And I just got bitten by the bug. I love the fact you can be a bit more considered. I love doing radio, the immediacy, the live thing. But I found it quite nerve-wracking. You know, you're sat there broadcasting to a couple of million people on Caroline and you made a fluff of the news bulletin. You'd feel, oh God. So I love that idea of writing something and polishing it. I also love music, and one thing led to another. Very fortunate for me, as I was kind of commuting between the UK and Ireland, this young band of four very hairy blokes called the Cranberry Saurus started. Mm. And they weren't bad. They sounded like the Smiths. They're pretty decent. Then the hairiest guy, the singer, left. And I thought, that was it. And my girlfriend at the time was at Laurel Hill School in Limerick and said, oh, one of the girls in my class is going to try out for your mate's band. I said, is she any good? And Aideen goes, well, she's very good in the choir. She does a great Ave Maria, but I don't think she's ever been to a rock gig. So I was going, ah, that's not going to happen, is it? And then she went to the rehearsal, dressed in her pink tracksuit with a Casio keyboard, went home that night with a kind of a doodling on cassette that Noel Hogan gave her of an instrumental track. And by the following morning, she'd written Linger. And then the next day, she wrote Dream. The Cranberries were born. So, you know, it was just so fortunate to be around a band from the humblest of youth club backgrounds, third on the bill on a Monday night, to playing to, 110,000 people upstate in, you know, Woodstock, New York.
Around the world, everywhere. Mexico City.
Not one, yeah. not one, but two popes, you know, singing for Princess Diana, singing with Pavarotti. You know, the stuff she did is quite amazing. And actually, my lockdown project was a Cranberries book. But to get back to Joe, yeah, he was there with the Mescaleros playing in Dublin. And I just was mad crazy to interview him. And he remembered Hot Press from before I was there and thought we were pretty cool. So he said, you know, we'll do the interview tonight. Well, that didn't happen because Joe sort of was with mates. And, you know, so I was told, come to Belfast the following night. So I did. Went up there. Gig was fantastic. It was a furnace. Like, Joe had to go off stage a couple of times. It was so hot. And he was getting on a bit. He was fit, but he was getting on. So we went upstairs to the dressing room. Tim Wheeler from Ash was there. And David Holmes, the film soundtracker, who's done the Killing Eve soundtrack. He's from Belfast. He was there. And Joe had a very big bag of very fresh grass.
Always.
So obviously it'd be rude to not partake, and I never have been a great consumer. Not a morality thing. I anyone can do what they want to if they're informed. You know, be my guest. So obviously I, you know, was kind of getting pretty out of it, and then I was going, Joe, you know, the interview, because the van driver had come in and said we've got to go to the port. So he said, don't worry, Stuart, don't worry. He said, come on to the tour bus and we'll do the interview there. So we go on board, and I go into his inner sanctum, and he's got the biggest ghetto blaster you've ever seen in your life.
I've
and
seen
two
it.
Suitcases full of dog-eared Dicks. Cassettes. and he'd be kind of like, I'll play a bit of ranchero music from Colombia. And he'd play it, and you'd be going, yeah. And then he'd go, no. And he'd take it out and put some Burundi on. I was just kind of like a child. It's like, Joe, so, you know, he's playing 30 or 40 seconds, then go, no, something else. So, you know, grass is still there. The wine's arrived. We're having a great party. I'm doing the interview. It's super. And, you know, I say, look, I better go. Basically, the guy who drove me up was waiting, you know, behind us. We were first in the queue in the van, and he was three or four behind us in a car. I said, I better go back to the car. So I get off a tour bus and I'm walking towards what I think is the car. I'm thinking it looks a bit odd in there, a bit dark. And someone shouts, where are you going? And I said, to the car. I said, well, you can't unless you can swim. We're 7 miles off of Belfast. And I go, what? So I'd left my jacket and all my money in the car. All I had was my phone and my dictaphone. So I go back in. It's a very long story, and I promise you I wasn't, but for some reason my girlfriend thought I was cheating on her at the time. She had suspicions.
Oh, God.
I wasn't, and I would admit it now. So she phones up saying, where are you? And I said, you'll never believe this. She goes berserk. Like, do you think I'm really stupid? Do you think I'm that thick?
Very natural reaction to that story, Stuart.
With Joe. So the next thing, like, Joe goes, hello, Joe Strummer here. We have your boyfriend. We'll try and send him back. And she's like, oh, you just make sure he gets home and he behaves himself, you know? So I'm getting a little bit emotional. And we go upstairs to the bar and the shop. And Joe spots this little concession stand. They got some cassettes, tapes. And he gets one, it's like 20 songs of Scotland. Now, he hasn't brought his ghetto blaster with him. So what he does is, look, what we're going to do is get rounds of drinks in. I'm going to point at somebody and you've got to get up, stand up and sing your impersonation, what you think the song sounds like. If it's good, you know, you get off scot-free. If it's bad, you have to drink the whole round.
Oh, God.
So, you know, they're playing a game of get the journalist slaughtered. It's an old-fashioned game. It can be fun for them, but there is a human price to be paid. So I got up and Bonnie Wee Girl of Kilmarnock was my song. He's like, ah, sorry, Stuart. So it's five double JDs. And for some reason, I kept on messing up. So we get to Stranraer. We drive off. Because, you know, they have to get off to get back on. They have a whip round for me. And they put like 70 or 80 quid in my pocket and all this kind of stuff. It was very, very kind of them. I had tried in the fetal position to crawl into the bunks. Joe sort of woke me up saying, you're gonna wake up in London and your girlfriend's going to be even crosser if you're in London tomorrow morning. So I, you know, say my goodbyes and hugs. And, you know, Joe says some very sweet things. We talk about how we're proud. He says he was as proud as a gnarly old mountain lion of the Clash, and it was our time and no one could take it away from us. So I was getting quite emotional. So I'm leaning on what I think is a solid piece of tour bus. It's actually the door. So somebody opens the door. I do a sort of triple somersault out, smash my head on the car deck, you know, concussing myself. An articulated lorry goes about 6 inches past my head. And I, of course, just burst into tears. So Strummer sort of like checks me for sort of breakages and bruises and stuff, and I'm quite woozy. But anyhow, he puts me back on the ferry, and somehow about a day and a half later, I got back to Dublin, and I had to take a couple of days off work. It broke
to recover,
and I went into the office. The receptionist said, "Somebody phoned for you. See how you were." I said, "Who? Mr. Rumner." Joe Rumner. I went, so Joe had phoned up to find out if I was alive or not.
So classy.
But you know what?
Such a class act.
You know him. He was everything you wanted him to be and more. If it had been a horrible person, I'd have been destroyed. But he just turned out to be this just wonderful, warm, passionate person that I hoped he would be. I knew he would be, actually.
When we have our pint in Dublin, I'm going to tell you about when I introduced him to Billy Joe from Green Day.
Oh, God, I've been an interesting meeting.
Oh, you are going to laugh your ass off when you hear this story. I can't say it on the radio, but you will laugh your ass off.
Those are the best kind of stories, the ones you can't broadcast.
No, I can't. He would be.
I want to hear that story.
Oh, God, Colin. Well, yeah, I'm still waiting for my sushi with you, so I don't know what's going on.
I know, yeah, we have to arrange it. Although I feel hungover just listening to that story, to be honest.
I can still feel it as myself, as a throbbing behind my temples even now.
Oh, my God.
Stuart, you mentioned Dolores earlier, and I'm intrigued with that story. I did meet her once in Miami 20 years ago, I guess. Yeah, at the Winter Music Conference, Chris Blackwell used to put like a party on at the Marlin Hotel he had in Miami, and Dolores was there with it's a mad lineup. It was Chris Blackwell was there, Tricky, Jeremy Guscott, right?
Oh wow,
Annie Nightingale. Yeah, it was real mad. But I was absolutely. It was quite a surreal party, but she was in party mode and she howled core. Do you know what I mean? She just commanded the room.
Dolores,
she really did.
When she was in full flow. Was magnificent.
And I was mesmerized by her. I just wanted to marry her. I just wondered how you came about to be, you know, to write the book. What occurred?
Well, Dolores and the boys were very, very loyal. And as they took off, they were thankful to me, which is very sweet of them, and thankful to Hot Press. I'd also done their very first radio interview on a local station in Limerick. So whenever they came back to Ireland, even when they weren't talking to the media, they would talk to us. And I would have seen the snapshots of, you know, sort of Dolores that way. And it was an arc that's all too familiar to anybody who's worked in the industry. At first, it was the kid in the sweet shop. You know, absolutely, oh my God, we met Michael Stipe and I've met Simon Le Bon. You know, he was on my wall about 6 years ago. Now I'm touring with him. Then it's kind of like, oh yeah, I'm a bit tired, you know. She was so close to her family that when she started getting like a year and a half of her life handed to her on a piece of paper, where you're going to be. And of course, being the lead singer and a girl, she couldn't just roll out of bed. The lads would like turn up 2 minutes before a photo shoot. But of course, Dolores had to be up at 6 for hair and makeup. She was the one they wanted to talk to in Japan and Australia. So it really fell on her shoulders. And she was so successful, but she was seeing life through a hotel, well, through a TV screen. You know, she said to me, you know, we had our CNN albums because I couldn't leave the hotel. There were people outside in the corridors wanting a piece of her, you know, in a nice way. Because the songs were very personal, people didn't just want an autograph. They wanted to have a cry with her and a hug and to tell her about their own sort of like feelings. And I think Dolores never claimed to be Bob Dylan. I think her genius was taking quite complex human emotions and expressing them quite simply in a universal fashion that a kid in Brazil could understand or somebody in New York. You know, I still think the first album is one of the best expressions of teenage love and angst. You know, the first romance. I hear it and I think of myself kissing Ruth Marshall, age 13. I was 14 too, I think.
Yeah. At a rugby club. But she was quite a shy... she was quite a shy person herself, though, really, wasn't she? Is that, you know, and maybe this was her telling her story. I don't know. I mean, you know more than me, but wasn't, you know, before she started performing, I'm sure I remember reading once that she had to really get over her nerves and stuff when she first started. Would that be true to
Yeah,
say,
on stage, yeah. She was a very fast learner, but yeah, the first gig I saw her play, she was looking at her feet, the drummer's head, the bassist's ass, anything but the crowd.
Very
but
Jim Morrison.
Within a few years, and again for the book, which is called Why Can't We? Available from hotpress.com, who've done it with the band, I got to speak to Simon Le Bon, who was a really close friend. And he was talking about the night that him and Dolores performed at Pavarotti's big gala in Modena for kids in the Balkans during that awful war. And Princess Diana was there in a big room, you know, with the sandwiches and the champagne.
Like she is, yeah.
And like she is. And because nobody would go near her, apart from, guess, one person walked across.
Yeah.
How are you? Dolores O'Riordan. And apparently she whispers in Diana's ear, do you want to go to the Jacks for a chat? The toilet. And Diana's going, I'd love to, but I'd have to bring 14 Secret Service. That was Dolores. You know, she would just go and do it. I think she was probably, she was shy of being on stage, nervous, but she had six brothers who were mostly bikers. You know, there was nothing shy and retiring about her. And she put me in my place, my God, a couple of times. There was always a glint in the eye. If I was getting a bit too prying, she'd tell me to butt out.
That I can say the time I met her, there was like some big names in that room, but she was holding court. Do you know what I mean? It was just like everyone was hanging on her every word. I fell for her, definitely. I thought she was fantastic. Yeah, but unfortunately, I didn't get to marry her.
She was very charismatic.
Maybe it's the obvious, but what would be your favourite Cranberries track then? What if you had to choose one?
Often I think the first song the band released is just the purest expression. And I think there's something about Linger. It's naive is perhaps the wrong word, but it's the world and love seen through the prism of an 18-year-old girl. And, you know, she had relationships, but not tons of them. And I, as I say, it brings me back to that place. Not just being in Limerick, but it brings me back to being young and heartbroken for the first time. And that album still stands up. I mean, the last album, funnily enough, in the end, she recorded it, you know, after a lot of personal difficulties. But she was back in the real world. She had a fabulous new boyfriend, Ollie Koretsky. She was living in New York, where you can hide in plain sight, as David Bowie said.
Yeah.
So she was going to the 7-Eleven to get her groceries. She was going out to get her hair done. She was going to the local, you know, so whatever. And she started writing about personal things, the stuff that had happened to her. And that's why I think it's a cracking album and the perfect bookend. And actually, it wasn't just a sympathy vote, the Grammy nod. I think that record deserved that Grammy nomination. Didn't win, but it was a really good, mature record. And if you listen to that and you listen to, you know, first album, you kind of work out a lot of her journey.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, in that case, it's a good job I've got that lined up then. Let's play a clip of Linger, shall we? Yeah, good shot.
Do it, Milfredo.
That's great. Stuart, when Hot Press was created, what was the concept, the original concept behind the magazine?
My boss, Niall Stokes, was very enthralled to Jan Venner and Rolling Stone.
Right.
And we didn't have a Vietnam War, but we had the troubles in the North that affected everybody. We also had a church that had a stranglehold on health and schools and reproductive rights. There were battles to fight. You know, I was in Tremore and nobody was gay. Of course they were, but nobody could come out. You just could not do it. If you had the audacity to move in with somebody, the priest would literally stand up in church on the Sunday and say, please express as strongly as possible your distaste for their behavior. I mean, that is just awful, awful stuff. You couldn't get contraception unless you begged the doctor, and then they got to make the moral decision on your behalf. All sorts of things, you know. So there were battles to fight, and Niall fought them. We were the first magazine to talk to loyalist terrorist stroke freedom fighters. It's in the eye, isn't it? People down south had spoken to people from the IRA, you know, the Catholic community and nationalism. But we kind of thought, okay, we may not like some of these people, but, you know, they are stakeholders. They are the reason these atrocities are happening. So would it not be a good idea to talk to them and try and understand where they're coming from? Can we not try and at least sort of, like, you know, see if there's some common ground, but at least to understand the situation? So we just believed in giving people a platform to speak their truth, I suppose. We've been campaigning. We've always been, you know, I suppose, trendy liberals. And there are still fights to be fought now, but they're not quite as pronounced as they were in the 70s and 80s.
Right. Musicians at the time in Ireland were reflecting all of this stuff, all of this turmoil that was going on around them.
They were and they weren't. You know, a lot of people in the North are bitter because they say the South turned its back on them. And I can see that because people were petrified about the awful things going in the North coming South. And they did on a couple of occasions. Bombs were planted in Dublin with a huge loss of life. You know, I probably am a bit more Republican, believe it or not, as an Englishman than some of my Irish friends. You know, it was only happening 110 miles up the road, but it might as well have been happening in Taiwan because, you know, you didn't cross the border, you didn't go to Belfast. And when you did, it was very surreal to be in a war zone that looked just like home.
And what did you feel about the Kenneth Branagh film? Did you like it?
I did like it.
Good portrayal. It was wonderful. I thought it was wonderful.
Yeah, I thought it was great. I mean, I'm not qualified because I didn't grow up there. And it was a very stylized version, obviously, and his impossibly good-looking parents. a lot of people in the North have a term, they call it troubles porn, and they do not like people coming in and exploiting their appalling history and hurt and grief for box office success. But Kenneth Branagh is one of their own, and everyone I've spoken to in Belfast who lived through it, enjoyed the film and thought it said something. And you know, there are a couple of films I'd say about the North that I'd recommend in particular. One is Good Vibrations, the story of Terry Hooley, the man who founded that record label and gave the Undertones their big break. And it shows how punk rock was the first time, or it got rid of sectarianism. It wasn't Catholic Protestant, it was Clash Sex Pistols.
Right.
And you went into gigs, to punk gigs, and the badge of honour was you did not talk about politics. And you didn't even have to give your first name, you had your punk rock name. So obviously if you're called William, that identifies you as one tradition or the other. Sean identifies you. So everyone had names like Rodent and Smelly and Fartface or whatever.
Gaz and Bez.
You're just mates into these really cool records. And that's another thing that I think was great about punk. You know, it meant a huge amount in the North, massive amount in the North.
But as a star journalist, I mean, you're in a very influential position. And what new artists or bands are exciting for you right now?
Oh, wait, let me get a pen. Wait, Stuart. Okay, I'm ready.
Do you know, it is, in terms of Irish music, I remember someone from a Greek magazine came over in the 1990s, wanted a soundbite about the Irish music scene. I gave it to them in about 30 seconds, and it was like Sinead O'Connor, U2, and Van Morrison. Now it's so broad. Like I say, we have David Holmes, you know, this amazing soundtracker who's worked with Sinead recently and with Noel Gallagher. We have a drill scene in Drogheda and all over the country. We've had a huge influx of people from all over the world. Similar to what, you know, New York would have gone through years ago, what the UK went through years ago. We have this melting pot of artists who aren't sort of saying, I'm going to work with a Nigerian person to make world music. The Nigerian kid just happens to be in school with them or was in work with them. So it's not a self-conscious world music project. Kids are making music and the members of the bands just happen to be from here, there and everywhere.
Incredible.
So Limerick has an amazing hip-hop scene. Denise Chyla is going to be a star. She already is here. There's a collective down there called Narrow Lane. There's a guy called Merley. and a guy called God Knows. It's his real name. And they're making astonishing music. We've got a band that sound a little bit like the Cranberries, but doing their own thing called New Dad. Mm. We have a new wave of Irish traditional music. And funny enough, it's Jeff Travis from Rough Trade Records, who signed the Smiths and everybody like that, who's taken it from Ireland to the UK. Bands like Lancome, The Vagabonds and The Scratch are offering a very modern take on traditional music. Then we have a band like the Fontaines DC, who are a post-punk band, but very steeped in Irish culture. Again, with a bit of a trad element and certainly Joycean lyrics. Fontaines DC are blowing up all over the place. They're doing really well in America. I'm just plugging Irish bands at the moment. We have the Pillow Queens, who are on James Corden the second time the other night from Dublin. Really good band. So, you know, this country is continually punching above its weight. But I think at the moment, the diversity of the music is striking.
Such a small place, but such a big voice, right?
But this is the problem in here in Ireland. You could go into any pub and come across the most amazing music. I mean, this place is littered with incredible talent.
Yeah.
Sorry, my Irish plug.
Yeah, Jason's become Irish.
Oh, I want to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I tell you, I'm seeking political asylum here. I see what's going on in the UK, and I ain't going back. They'd have to drag me back in a pine box.
I think we're going to play a clip of the Fontaines right now, right, Milfredo? Now the wind is making work of every step on the bridge. You say, I used to say we found each other. Now I don't know where he is. You get that feel, make your spirit shine. I let a prize up at my ribcage like a crackhead at the blinds. It hurts, but come the down and I'll be scrap, yeah, son. There is no life out on a failure. It ain't cool.
Oh, man, so sinister. I can hear a Milfredo remix of that already.
It's a really fantastic record. And what's lovely is there used to be this expression that, you know, it was too Irish to travel. And funny enough, you know, Dolores O'Riordan insisted on singing in her Limerick accent. And the further she roamed from Limerick, the more Irish she sounded. But if you listen to Van Morrison, you know, who's a great artist, but it's mid-Atlantic. You know, them, yeah. But it's mid-Atlantic because that's what people felt you had to do. The Fontaines DC don't have subtitles. You know, they are raw and Irish. And if you get it, if you're in America or New Zealand, great. They're not going to translate it for you. And I love that about Irish culture. There's a real confidence now to I'd say, ourselves. Yeah. But I you know, think that this country has come of age in terms of confidence in its abilities.
Did you ever come across Brian Deedy?
Yes. Brian's an interesting fellow.
What, you know, an interesting story that guy is. What do you think of him?
I don't know too much about the backstory, but I've seen him play, and it's a really interesting fusion of music. We are a nation of mavericks, I suppose, and there are some really great outsider characters. Brian qualifies. There's a guy from Dundalk called Jinx Lennon.
You get a chance? Oh, yeah.
I don't even know how to describe Jinx. He's just a one-off. And actually, just to go back a little bit by pop psychology, when I first arrived in Ireland, if a band got to number 85 in the UK, it was almost a national day of celebration.
Yeah.
then you too, you know, after, you know, Thin Lizzy queued up, you know,
they broke down all the walls.
They queued up you too, but suddenly Ireland had the biggest band in the world. And at the same time, a swine called Ray Houghton stuck the ball in the English net. To translate that soccer.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
England had never been beaten by Ireland. And I had to watch that in a pub full of Irish people. I learned humility that day. But I don't know whether you'd agree with this, Colin, but honestly, there was a shift in that national psyche. And then it was like rubber stamp when Ireland beat England in Croke Park in the rugby. It's like, yeah, we've done that now. We don't have to feel inferior. There was no inferiority complex. The chip was off both shoulders.
Yeah, I think so. And it's funny you mentioned, like, you know, with bands and stuff like that about sounding too Irish or needing to be more Americanized to go over to America. I remember even when I first went to LA, I had 8 minutes in an episode of The Tudors and somebody contacted me. And I'd spoken to a couple of agents here at the time that I had, and they were like, well, no, really, you should have you know, sort of a bigger movie to go over. And I was in my head, I was like, somebody's reached out to me. And that's when I went over, and 6 months later, I was sitting with Anthony Hopkins playing the lead opposite him in a movie.
Right. Wow.
But if I had taken the advice to not go over, to go over with something bigger or something that was a bigger hit in America, then my whole career from then on would never have happened. Do you know what I mean? And it's that sort of mentality. I don't think that's here anymore. I think people are like, well, no, I'm good. I'm good at what I do, and I have belief, you know? And that all comes from that place of what you're talking about. There was a definite shift in the psyche of Irish people, you know?
I think so. It's interesting. You look at the credits for any Hulu, HBO or Showtime series, and there's always at least one Irish actor. It's just incredible when you think of the country. I mean, we are the size of Greater Birmingham, you know? And how many actors come out of Birmingham every year? How many artists? You know, probably not that many. It's a country of probably 5.5 million now. It's quite incredible.
Well, Birmingham, are you really? Come on, you got the Specials, you got the English Beats, you got... Oh, wait, that's a long time ago, sorry.
That were Coventry, half of it.
Oh, Coventry was the Specials, but the beat was the Birmingham.
I know, I'm not trying to be mean to Birmingham, but each year, I think if you look at the size of the country, it is pretty incredible. And even the amount of media we have, friends of mine come across and say, you've got what, like 5 TV stations? And you've got like 30 radio stations? You've got a population of... So it's interesting, but...
Do you know Stuart? That confidence to sing in your own accent, if you look at the evolution of Irish drill, when they first started, and if you looked in New Zealand drill at the moment with all kind of the Maori gangs and stuff, they're all rapping in Brixton accents, and early Irish drill, they was kind of doing the same. Do you know what I mean, bruv? And then it was almost like they just thought, do you know what? What we do sounds great. We don't need to sound like a Brixton rapper. And you can hear that kind of change in mentality. And it's you know, and there's lots of countries doing drill and are trying to sound like London rappers. And it's hats off to the Irish. It's just like, this is us. And that makes it real, doesn't it? It's not fake then. They're telling their story about Belfast or Dublin or wherever it is in an Irish accent. It's just it makes sense.
Absolutely. Two more artists to check out for that very reason. For Those I Love, it's an extraordinary album. And also Kojak. And again, that's Irish rap talking about what's on its doorstep in its own accent and really delivering some knockout punches. But going back to Denise Chyla, you know, Denise is originally from Zambia. She had an interesting sort of journey to get to Limerick. She's an extraordinary woman, so articulate. Her lyrics are just fantastic. So, yeah, there's so much to check out from here.
I think the thing is that Irish people aren't scared anymore to express themselves. I think I think for so long, as Stuart touched on earlier on, Ireland was, you know, sort of consumed by the church and by the limitations. I mean, you have to remember that, look, even when I was young, Clockwork Orange was banned, you know, The Exorcist was banned, you couldn't get your hands on any of these. You could, at one point, Ulysses was banned here, all that kind of stuff. And people just, you know, were kept down. And I think the difference is that nowadays, Irish people, you know, we're proud of our culture and we're proud of the fact that we're artistic, that we're storytellers, and I think that
poets
and everything, and I think that is what Irish people, they don't feel confined anymore. They don't have to conform to a very, very strict
Do you think that started with like Sean Rudin or is it more modern? Do you think that those early architects helped to break those walls down, Colin?
I think, honestly, I think it's close to what Stuart said. I think it was in like the late 80s, early 90s. I think it's sort of, there was a shift where people just said, we're not going to put up with being told everything ourselves. You know, we're going to express ourselves. We're going to, I don't know, I'm sure that the sort of the internet, TV, more exposure to, like, I remember even when I was young trying to get certain movies, certain albums, they were impossible to get. And this is like, you're talking about, I was born in 81, so you're talking about the 80s, early 90s. That's not that long ago, no. You know? You couldn't even get, I know this sounds weird, but you couldn't even get condoms in the country
Yeah.
up until Do you know what I mean?
You didn't even have cars. You barely had cars in the 80s. What are you talking about?
No, but I'm talking about the 90s even. You know what's that?
That was exactly. I remember a friend of mine going back with his girlfriend to England from Tremore, and his grandmother saying, "So, what's it like living in a shanty town, dear? And you have electricity." But to be honest, England still has the most ignorant, and I say it as an English person, opinion of Ireland. We see this, well, certain English people. You know, the reading by Boris and his kind of cohorts, what Ireland is just so far removed from the truth. You know, they haven't quite realised that we're a very modern, fiercely independent, proud and able nation. And you know, it's funny, you only get to know your own country's values when you're outside of it. I'm afraid that Britons stink, and I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, so Stuart, this is Kevin. This is a real treat, I have to say. Number one, it is the best. And, you know, I saw Pirate Radio, and I don't know how true it rang, but, you know, just watching that movie, I remember wondering, you know, could I connect with anybody like that, anyone that was a part of that movement? It really did help to change the dynamics of things. But, you know, I really feel that that was really about a movement more than anything. I mean, punk was a movement, and I still feel that that movement still rings true. I mean, you talk about the Irish. I'm a big hip hop fan. I'm a big Bowie fan and everyone else that you mentioned, but I'm a big hip hop fan. And it's really great to hear about that Irish hip hop movement. I believe it's from the streets and it's a counterculture movement as well. So it's really great to hear a lot of the artists that you're talking about. But I do want to kind of harken back to the thought about your career, which sounds tremendous. What do you feel that maybe your proudest moment in your career has been so far? And do you have any favorite moments?
I'll be honest with you. I've been very fortunate to look some of my heroes in the eye and actually shake their hands and thank them. I got to thank David Bowie. Lemmy, of course, was another Motorhead for me. Greatest. He was the ultimate outsider. And again, you know, reduced to a cartoon.
Motorhead.
Incredibly complex man. And unrelenting, he stuck to his guns, you know, and went from being a laughing stock to the coolest man in the world.
The coolest.
You know, I think probably when I arrived on Caroline, because to give you an idea, it looked like the boat that rocked, but we didn't have fancy clothes and we didn't have anybody coming out on boats at that time. And we were stuck on the boat for like 12, 13 weeks. And the only people we saw were the police coming out to take pictures of us. So we had a ready stash of balaclavas with which to greet them. but I think when I arrived on Caroline, it was the biggest pirate ship that had ever been at sea with the tallest mast, something like 285 feet tall. I was a bit overawed by it, I'll be honest. But I just think I went, you dreamt of this. You dreamt of it and you're here. And that was a moment. I mean, you know, I have been humbled to work with some great people. And like, I've always worked with people who are better than me, which is annoying, but aspirational. So I have a healthy sense of my place. I was the T-boy on Radio Caroline. I was the hippie newsreader predominantly. But yeah, I think being on Caroline probably was the biggest adventure and something I just still pinch myself about.
Would you recommend people to see that particular movie?
They had a guy called Johnny Walker, who's a big broadcasting icon in the UK, who was on Caroline in the 60s as the consultant. So all the gear was the right gear and how they used the equipment was right. And the boat kind of looked right, but the storyline was a bit daft. But it gives you a flavor. There's another brilliant film called 3 Mile Limit. And it's about Radio Hauraki off the New Zealand coast that spent 1,111 days at sea. Their first boat, you know, was shipwrecked and they had to abandon ship. And that is even more, to me, sort of about Caroline's sort of us against the system kind of ethos. That's a really good movie if you can find it somewhere, 3 Mile Limit.
Stuart, I wanted to know, since you started in the business, what have been the positive and negative changes that you've seen in the industry over the years?
I think the negative is Spotify, to be honest, and some of the other streaming services. Bands just aren't being paid enough for their music. There's been a land grab, I'm afraid, that needs to be addressed. You know, 90% of income now comes from live records are pretty much a lost leader. And merch, and of course, the last 2 years, there was no gigs to sell merch at, so bands really, really suffered. What is great, though, is the fact you don't need $1,000 a day to go into a studio. You can make stuff in your own room. You can, without the permission of Jason, without the permission of Mr. Warner or the BBC or RTE, you can just go and do it. And that's why I think we're in a bit of a golden age in terms of the amount of music and the quality of it. So technology has both liberated and destroyed, I suppose, the economic model. I think for a long time, we sort of shook our fist, you know, at the sun, kind of going, damn you. But obviously now you've got artists who didn't grow up with the old model, who aren't angry about that passing. So I suppose these kids are more streetwise. I think also there's less naivety, that there's the access to information. You know, people were signing awful record deals in the 70s and 80s and 90s. Whereas now, you know, kids can go to BIM Music College in Dublin, where the Fontaines DC went, and they learn how to write songs and how to perform and how to be, you know, disciplined. They also learn how to read a spreadsheet and how to read a legal contract. And there's a clue in the term music business. It is a business. We all want to say it's creative, but of course that's what drives it. The creativity drives it. And without it, there is nothing. It implodes. But you've got to be streetwise and know where the sharks swim. I think kids today are much smarter and aware of that kind of thing than they used to be.
Without a doubt. You are so right on, right on.
To that end then, Stuart, how do you think NFTs are going to make a difference to artists?
There are areas where I am a Luddite. And NFTs, I have yet to get my head round. I have some reading to do. It's a bit like I got a TikTok masterclass the other day from our new media person. And Grandad was there going, Jesus, but I'll get with the project. So give me a couple of weeks and I'll be an expert on NFTs. But at the moment, I just do not understand them. That's been totally honest. And one has to adapt or die. So less of my dinosaur sort of mentality.
Mm-hmm. It's actually, honestly, from, you know, as a former label executive, I have to say it's one of the most exciting prospects that's come into the music industry in a long time. You know, when the digital age came in, I just saw all of my friends, all the talent that I know, just completely lose that fluid income that they relied on. Mm. The minute music became worthless, you know, everybody expects it for free. I find NFTs the salvation.
The salvation how, Jason? Because they can make money again?
So many levels, rights? Actually. Well, it's because of the what the blockchain signifies and what it does, you know? It's like from every perspective, if you're a Patty Casey, for example, and you want to make a new album, instead of signing 50% away to a label that really does nothing anymore these days, you can now get the fans, give away 20% of the copyright and master to the fans. Let them own and earn along with you. And
but in the music industry, what's the great equalizer? Because like in our industry, it was Netflix. So there was, you know, there was a leveling out of no box office. So a film like Coda, which sold for $24 million at Sundance, made $1,000 at the box office. But it made 10 times more by just the straight sale. But then there's nothing after that. So what you're saying is the NFTs are going to increase the ancillary things that we're missing in other forms of distribution?
Not so much for distribution, but yes. But if, for example, like with Collins trading card, right? We're getting ready to launch this amazing new trading card. It's the first in a series. But when somebody, when a Colin O'Donoghue fan buys one of those trading cards, then as Colin's career continues to flourish and blossom, that card becomes more valuable. So that owner of their NFT can now sell that to a new fan and make money. But it's not just the owner of the NFT that's making money. Colin forever owns a piece of that. So every time it's sold, he's getting a royalty. I mean, this is, it's just an amazing opportunity for artists and for us, because we're opening up
in all, you know, Colin's third tier NFT, he actually is dancing in the animation. So we're opening that up to our music community, saying, submit your music, bring your music to us. Then we're going to have an iconic DJ, Milfredo 7, do the remix. So there's all these connectivities. There's all these possibilities. You know, it's limited by your creativity. So I'm actually excited to see how Warner's, Universal, Sony, how they deal with this. But honestly, it's going to be very exciting the next few years.
No, it sounds like a brave new world, doesn't it?
Oh, it's exciting.
According to my Instagram, Colin, there are a lot of people in Brazil that are waiting for those NFTs. Colin was laughing because my Colin Instagram comes to me in Portuguese and it's from Brazil.
She said to me, you know that your Instagram, when I look at it, is all in Portuguese. And I was like, what? And then I looked at her and she was following a fan Instagram. It wasn't me at all. I said, no, that's not me, Rose. And she said, well, it's a good thing I speak Portuguese then, isn't it?
You have the most beautiful, committed fan base I've ever seen, Colin. These people, I mean, we just started talking about the NFT. I'm already getting financial offers from people. I'm like, no. Wait. You can't just buy it right now. It's not ready. Yeah.
Well, get onto this Brazilian site, Jason.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm in touch with him, actually. He's amazing, this guy. I love, and I didn't know if I was talking with Colin or him at first.
Yeah. Well, anyway.
Just a quickie on Stuart. You know, you're saying about that the kids are a lot more savvy now with regards to the legal aspects of the music industry. And I came from a background where, you know, you had to be sharp on the estate to survive. And I was the sharpest tool on the estate. I go into the music industry and I got ripped off left, right and center because I just had no idea. And I'm glad that you say that. That is a big, big positive. You know, it's just... we were on Top of the Pops and that was just as good as it got for me. I didn't really care about the contract I just signed. Do you know what I mean? And and I think people played on that. So yeah, you're right. That is massive.
Trust me, Milfredo, you didn't get screwed half as bad as the guys from the 60s. And on top of that, imagine the black artists in America from the 40s and 50s that we've completely
ripped off. All the grill building people and acts.
I think too, though, on what Stuart said, I think it's one thing. I hope that drama schools and stuff for actors, and they do the same thing where they teach people, because people get so passionate about wanting to work and stuff, they forget that actually it is a business as well.
It's a business.
You really, really need to be on top of things, you know, so that you know that you're not going to get screwed over all across the board, music, film, all that kind of stuff. Because the majority of people going in on the artist side are artists and just want to create stuff. You know what I mean? And forget
that's not good enough anymore. You got to be savvy. You got to be aware of what's going on.
We can't teach the arts anymore in a purely conservatory fashion. You know, I was the first one to teach a business course at NYU Film School, Tisch. And it was called The Business of the Biz. And there was no room in the theater where I gave the class every week. It was tons of kids because they were getting all screwed over,
It's gotten to that time. I just want to say, look, Stuart, thank you so much. It's been an absolutely amazing conversation tonight. It's been fascinating. You know, we really appreciate it.
Hey guys.
Hey Jace.
Hey Jason, you okay?
Yeah, I'm good, just buried in paperwork.
Oh, for the sync report.
Not this time. Move me no mountain.
That indie film you're music supervising?
Yeah.
Sounds like a great project. What's the problem?
It's a brilliant film and we're building a great soundtrack, but you can't imagine how much paperwork I deal with for these films.
Have you heard of Sync Lodge?
First, you got to draft up the sync request forms.
I've heard of Sync Lodge.
Then drafting and issuing contracts.
Yep, Sync Lodge is great, Paula. It does everything a music supervisor needs.
Then deliver the cue sheet. It never ends.
Doesn't Sync Lodge do all of that automatically?
Sweat Lodge? What are you guys banging on about? I got real issues I'm sharing with you guys.
Yeah, lots of issues.
We're trying to tell you, Jason. Sync Lodge is a new platform for music supervisors. It helps you to source the music, sync songs against scenes, draft up sync requests, and even creates the cue sheets once you've locked in the music to the film.
Whoa, Sync Lodge does all that?
It It's true, Jason. I just started using it for the sync report. And it's not only saving time, but it's so easy to use, I'm actually enjoying the work.
You guys are the best. Sync Lodge sounds amazing and exactly what I need for music supervising. Why am I always the last one to hear about these things?
I've been telling you about Sync Lodge for weeks.
Don't feel bad, Edge, for not telling me sooner. I know you're busy. You're a good guy.
Paula, is my mic on? Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, Edge.
Guys, what's the name of that program again?
Sync Lodge.
That is something to scream about. Yes, you too can be cool like Edge and use cutting edge technology to help you with your film and TV productions. No matter if you're a music supervisor, director, producer, editor, save time and increase proficiency with Sync Lodge.
I need to find a new gig.
Sync opportunities, sync opportunities.
What fun we're going to have tonight as we listen to some music from you guys, our audience members, for the Sync Report Sync Session Sunday. Oh, I got a headache after that. Hi, guys. Oh, it looks like it's just us on stage now. How's it going, Paula? Did you eat your dinner?
Hello, what? What?
Did you eat your dinner?
Who are you? I've had my dinner.
Did you have bolognese?
No, I didn't. No. I do have risotto, though. So, you know.
Oh, risotto. Italian. That's tough. That's not an easy preparation.
Risotto's easy. What are you talking about? Oh, my God. It's so easy. Me. I'll teach you in a couple of weeks' time.
Excellent. All right. Then we're going to get the Airbnb and you'll have to have our own kitchen.
On second thought.
Ah, don't do that to me.
I am in the middle of a bottle of wine, so I'll agree to anything.
Well, I'm in the middle of a bottle of Johnny Walker that was supplied to me from my beautiful friends at the Sync Report.
Lovely.
Yeah, you know, you're surrounded by good people when they send you bottles of alcohol. Either that or they have no respect for you at all. You're like, oh, he's a fucking drunk. Send him a bottle.
We just know you're like more that. Fun when you're drunk, Jason.
It's very true. I'm a complete asshole unless I'm drunk. So anyways, let's say hello to the four members of the team that are here. Jody, how are you doing? We got a new look coming for our visuals. I'm so excited what you're doing. I just saw something that is now we're starting to reflect some of the visuals because we're making all of this animated content that you're going to start to play with. Is that kind of fun?
It is amazing. When I looked at all the pictures, I mean, it's really going to make the visuals pop. Really, really cool visuals. Really well done. And I'm very excited to experiment and to even have the opportunity to be using those. So very cool.
Oh, I love you, Jody. And it is. Wait till the world sees this. I mean, this is unlike any metaverse out there that anybody's seen because the show itself, we're doing everything in Unreal Engine, which is like, if you don't know what Unreal Engine is, it's like, this is what Sony PlayStation uses for all their top tier games. It's what the, you know, like Unreal Mortal Engines and, you know, like some of the most amazing special effects is being done with Unreal. And we have some of the most leading experts in Unreal creating our TV show. So it's so exciting. In fact, talent is starting to be booked for the TV show itself. The first show will happen second week of January. But until then, you're going to be able to get some sneak peeks through Jody's artwork. So make sure you're following us on our socials. Make sure you're signed up to the newsletter so you know what's going on and you're the first to see all this exciting stuff. Thank you, Jody, for everything you're doing. You're a game changer in the Sync Report, and I absolutely adore you.
Oh, back at ya.
Lisa Dunn, how you doing, woman?
I'm good. Yeah, no, I had a very long day yesterday.
Watching a crack house burn.
And we drove down to the coast. I had a 2-hour gig outside, sang to a bunch of Walker buyers and some random stranger dancing and
some busking.
And then we drove back at like 12 o'clock at night. So I got home at about 4 and...
Aye, aye, aye.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. I can't keep up with you young people. That is amazing. So, and you are doing an amazing job, Lisa, with everything else besides the research and helping us with the show flows, writing the show flows. All right. Okay. Let's keep going. Phil, you're here. How lovely to see your face.
Hello, my friend. How are you this evening? All right?
Yeah, I'm good, actually. I'm up to my knee in Johnny Walker, so I'm feeling good.
Of course.
Up to the waist.
and I'll be on fire.
Good to see you all. Good to see the team in all looking good this evening.
Yeah, we're back. I've been gone for 2 weeks.
I know. We thought you'd left.
Yeah, I was honestly, you know, there's so many other great rooms I was participating in.
Of course, I had the plaque changed on your office door and everything, you know, but you're back. So welcome back, Jason. Good to have you back, buddy.
Thank you. You're the first one to welcome me back. And how are you doing? Yeah, I know we're getting these shows to you, not on a timely fashion, but you're still delivering the Foley and the music supervising. And now you've actually been promoted. I'm so pleased that you are the music director of the Sync Report. What a cool thing. How lucky for us to have you, Phil. I adore
That's
you.
Very cool.
You are absolutely one of the most talented musicians I've come across in a long time.
Oh, bless you. Checks in the post, buddy. Thanks ever so much. Very kind. You say all the right things. No, it's going to be cool. This is going to be a great journey. I'm looking forward to, digging in really deep. This is going to be great fun.
Thank you for everything that you're doing, Phil. Honestly, we couldn't be doing the show without you. I mean, this team is just made up of such stellar talent. And in fact, our newest full-time member, Heather, how's it going, lady?
Hello, I'm very good. I was in Quebec City this weekend and...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that was fun. Not that much, honestly. There was a guy playing Disney songs on his saxophone and I went for steak. Yeah. we just felt like going on a little road trip. It's not even that far away.
Sounds like you had fun.
It was fun. I had chocolate-covered popcorn and caramel-covered popcorn. So trying new things every day.
That must be good for the
teeth. Oh, yeah. Big Nelly.
Well, Heather, I'm loving you being part of this team, and I am so lucky to have you. Thank you for everything that you're doing.
Oh, thank you. It means a lot.
I see our greatest panelist has arrived. Vinx, how's it going, my favorite human?
My beautiful peoples, how you doing?
Yay, welcome, Vinx. Oh, and I got your email. I see you have booked your flights. That is so exciting. You're going to be in Dublin with us.
Well, I can't wait. I'm looking so forward to being the Black Leprechaun, you know. I'm just spent my whole life trying to arrive to that vibe, you know.
Well, so honestly, I just can't wait to get a big Vinx hug on. That is my excitement.
I like that. I got to get that T-shirt, a hug on. I need to get a hug on.
Give me my Vinx. Give me my Vinx on. Vinx on, Vinx off. I am the Karate Kid. Yeah, so tonight, as you guys have probably noticed, there is no Kevin tonight. Unfortunately, Kevin has some family stuff he's dealing with, so our director won't be a panelist. But we have Phil and Vinx being the panel for tonight. And, of course, the rest of the team is welcome to weigh in. And we are going to be listening to Dream Pop, one of my favorite genres of music for film. It's just an incredible, you know, it's not new, you know. It's, you know, it's, this has been happening for a long time. But for many of it's kind of a new way of reinventing great songs in a more theatrical, more dramatic, more emotional delivery. So I'm excited to see what our audience actually has for us tonight. Why don't we get into this thing? Paula, why don't you tell us who our first victim is?
You got to choose another word instead of victim.
It's, I mean, what else would you call these poor people that are putting their art in front of what? An unsuspecting
brave soul.
Brave soul. All right. Well, that sounds extremely nice, Paula.
Okay, so
who is the first brave soul?
Our next song is called Still With Me, and it's by Jess Rodriguez.
Play it, no brader. Oh, I love this woman.
Now is torn. When I
it to my girl, Jess. Oh, my God. That's dream pop. That is beautiful. That song was gorgeous. Jess, say hello. Tell us some background on that track. That's something new I've never heard of yours.
Hi, guys. I love you so much.
We love you back. You know we do.
Oh, it's good to hear everyone's voices. That one gets me all teary-eyed. It's actually the only, in October, it'll be 10 years since I lost my mom. And so it's the only song I really have written about her. Took a really long time to even consider writing about her. And of course, it was like very emotional when it happened. And it was all just inspired by having her things, like her actual items, like a plate and a sweater and old jewelry and, like, you know, my kids breaking something. And just sort of like this long over time saying goodbye to, like, oh, there's another one of mom's planters that, like, is destroyed now, and sort of kind of saying goodbye to the material possessions of her and, like, letting go of all these things and knowing that she's still with me. So, yeah.
Oh, it was, well, even more beautiful after actually hearing that, Jess. And you just, what an incredible artist.
I'm just going to interrupt you here. I'm so sorry. We have a new panelist on stage.
Who's that, Paula?
Midas Royal.
No, how exciting. Welcome, Midas.
Aha, thank you. Yes. But I wanted to let you know, Jess is an incredible songwriter. Her music has such an authentic feel. It comes from a real beautiful place, and that song really came across very, very well. Nice job, Jess.
Thank you, my friend Midas. I love you. Always on your team, too. So you guys are making me teary-eyed. Thank you so much.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Midas. I couldn't have said it any better. All right, let's roast this woman. Vinks, tell us what you thought.
I loved it. It was how do you say, a truth in the drama. And it brings home the whole concept that the sexiest part of a woman is the heart. And she leads with that first. And for me, it was great. I mean, it was just a inhale drama attached to it. So I think it works in a lot of different places for you. And congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, that was gorgeous. Paula Flack, who are we bringing up next? Who is the next brave contender in this battle for the best?
Well, the next brave soul has sent us a song called Drive, and it is by Claire Arena featuring Chew the producer. Play it, Milfredo.
Oh, Chew.
Cost me a lot. The only cost of staying in your mind, drifting far behind.
God, Chew, I think that's my favorite track of yours. That was gorgeous. That was dream pop. That was so, oh my God, you have my juices flowing. Tell me about that track, Chew.
First off, thank you. That's a track with a three-way collaboration with Anthony Ferrier. He produced it. And then Claire and I put together the vocals, and they kind of brought me in late in the project. They felt that for whatever reason they felt it needed me. I didn't think it did. I think they were doing just fine. It sounded amazing when they brought it to me, and I just kind of did what they asked me to do and threw my funk on it.
You have just made my day. I love it. That track was gorgeous. But let's hear what the rest of the guys have to say. Vinks, what do you think?
One of the things it reminded me of is with old folks' wisdom that silence is a note, and they gave us enough time to really process it, and it goes through beautifully with behind the conversation or the scene in any kind of situation.
Right.
So I think it's perfect, laid back, and important to be the director of ambiance in a sense. So I thought it was a great move.
Thanks, capsulized it perfectly, Chew. This is what we're looking for: is music that's not going to compete with the dialogue that's happening in a scene. Something that is going to be subtle enough, but dramatic and theatrical. And this song is the personification of dream pop. Phil, what do you think? Am I crazy?
No, I think you're right. Vinks nailed it for me too. I was really enjoying the space. I really liked the bass sound, just the single note and then the vocal and the single note and the vocal and the dryness at the end of it. It just gave lots of room around the track. So, Chew, great job, man. If you produced that one, it's or co-produced it, yeah, whatever. It's that collaboration works really good, man. I can see that in a film, no problem. Good job.
That was brilliant, Chew. You continue to bring amazing music to our room. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
So thank you to you guys, our community, the ones that continue to show up. Thank you, Jody, Lisa, Paula, Phil, Heather, Stacy Montgomery. You're here. I love you, my Stacy, my sister. Midas, I'm so glad you've joined us on a different side of the fence tonight. You were brilliant with your commentary. Phil, as always, you're spot on. I love this crowd. I love this community. Have yourself a great week.
Bye-bye.
Thank you to Stuart Clark for joining us on today's show, and to you, our listeners, for spending your time with us. The Sync Report cast will be back in a week with your hosts, Rose Ganguza, Jason P. Rothberg, and myself, Colin O'Donoghue. Until next time, take care and be kind.
Thank you for listening. Tune in next week.
Today's episode was produced by Jason P. Rothberg, Kevin Sharpley, Paula Flack, and Robert Capadonna. It was written by Jason P. Rothberg, Kevin Sharpley, Lisa Dunn, and Paula Flack. Editing was by Jason P. Rothberg, Milfredo Seven, Paula Flack, Edgar Edge Kamei, and Adam McNamara. Research by Lisa Dunn. Graphic design by Jody Lynn Talevi. Brought to you by Zavatar.